Chapter 4. I put my head out of the window and shrieked out a laugh, but made no other reply. "What's the joke, George?" said Dudley. "Did I say anything witty?" "No," cried I, yelling still more wildly, "nothing more witty than usual." "Don't be severe, George," said he, with a mortified air, and we drove on to B House. ... There must have been something strange and wild in my appearance, and those awful black plumes, as I passed through the crowd, for I observed people looking and making a strange nasal noise. It is called sniffing, and I have no other more delicate term for it, and making way as I pushed on. But I moved forward very fiercely, for the wine, the maraschino, the eau de cologne, and the excitement had rendered me almost wild. And at length I arrived at the place where my lovely lady of the lake and her harper stood. How beautiful she looked! All eyes were upon her as she stood blushing. When she saw me, however, her countenance assumed an appearance of alarm. "Good heavens, George," she said, stretching her hand to me, "what makes you look so wild and pale?" I advanced, and was going to take her hand, when she dropped it with a scream. "Ah, ah, ah," she said. "Mr. Fitzpoodle, you've been smoking." There was an immense laugh from 400 people round about us, and the scoundrelly Dudley joined in the yell. I rushed furiously out, and, as I passed, hurtled over the fat hereditary prince of Kalbsbrut and Pumpernickel. "Es riecht hier an Jehuer Stark von Tabak," I heard His Highness say, as I madly flung myself through the aides-de-camp. The next day Mary Malister, in a note full of the most odious good sense and sarcasm, reminded me of our agreement, said that she was quite convinced that we were not by any means fitted for one another, and begged me to consider myself henceforth quite free. The little wretch had the impertinence to send me a dozen boxes of cigars, which, she said, would console me for my lost love, as she was perfectly certain that I was not mercenary, and that I loved tobacco better than any woman in the world. I believe she was right, though I have never to this day been able to pardon the scoundrelly stratagem by which Dudley robbed me of a wife and won himself. As I was lying on his sofa, looking at the moon and lost in a thousand happy contemplations, Lord Dudley, returning from the tailor's, saw me smoking at my leisure. On entering his dressing room, a horrible treacherous thought struck him. "Must not betray my friend," said he, "but in love all is fair, and he shall betray himself." There were my tartans, my cursed feathers, my tiger skin sporran, upon the sofa. He called up my groom, he made the rascal put on all my clothes, and, giving him a guinea and four cigars, bade him lock himself into the little pantry and smoke them without taking the clothes off. John did so, and was very ill in consequence, and so when I came to B House, my clothes were redolent of tobacco, and I lost lovely Mary Malister. I am godfather to one of Lady Dudley's boys, and hers is the only house where I am allowed to smoke unmolested. But I have never been able to admire Dudley, a sly, sour-noise, spiritless, lily-livered fellow that took his name off all his clubs the year he married Dorothea. Beyond sparring and cricket, I do not recollect I learned anything useful at Slaughterhouse School, where I was educated according to an old family tradition, which sends particular generations of gentlemen to particular schools in the kingdom. And such is the force of habit, that though I hate the place, I shall send my own son thither to, should I marry any day. I say I learned little that was useful at Slaughterhouse, and nothing that was ornamental. I would as soon have thought of learning to dance, as of learning to climb chimneys. Up to the age of 17, as I have shown, I had a great contempt for the female race, and when age brought with it warmer and juster sentiments, where was I? I could no more dance nor prattle to a young girl than a young bear could. I have seen the ugliest little low-bred wretches carrying off young and lovely creatures, twirling with them in waltzes, whispering between their glossy curls in quadrilles, simpering with perfect equanimity, and cutting paws in that abominable avalier soul, until my soul grew sick with fury. In a word, I determined to learn to dance. But such things are hard to be acquired late in life, when the bones and the habits of a man are formed. Look at a man in a hunting field who has not been taught to ride as a boy. All the pluck and courage in the world will not make the man of him that I am, or as any man who has had the advantages of early education in the field. In the same way with dancing. Though I went to work with immense energy, both in Brewer Street, Golden Square with an advertising fellow, and afterwards with old Cowlin at Paris, I never was able to be easy in dancing, and though little Cowlin instructed me in a smile, it was a cursed forced one, that looked like the grin of a person in extreme agony. I once caught sight of it in a glass, and have hardly ever smiled since. Most young men about London have gone through that strange secret ordeal of the dancing school. I am given to understand that young snobs from attorneys' offices, banks, shops, and the like, make not the least mystery of their proceedings, in the saltatory line, but trip gaily, with pumps in hand, to some dancing place about Soho, waltz and quadrille it with Miss Greengrocer or Miss Butcher, and fancy they have had rather a pleasant evening. There is one house in Dover Street, where, behind a dirty curtain, such figures may be seen hopping every night, to a perpetual fiddling, and I have stood sometimes wandering in the street, with about 6 blackguard boys wondering too, at the strange contortions of the figures jumping up and down to the mysterious squeaking of the kit. Have they no shame, says Jens? Are such degrading initiations to be held in public? No, the snob may, but the man of refined mind never can submit to show himself in public laboring at the apprenticeship of this most absurd art. It is owing, perhaps, to this modesty, and the fact that I had no sisters at home, that I have never thoroughly been able to dance, for though I always arrive at the end of a quadrille and thank heaven for it too. And though, I believe, I make no mistake in particular, yet I solemnly confess I have never been able thoroughly to comprehend the mysteries of it, or what I have been about from the beginning to the end of the dance. I always look at the lady opposite, and do as she does. If she did not know how to dance, par hazard, it would be all up. But if they can't do anything else, women can dance. Let us give them that praise at least. In London, then, for a considerable time, I used to get up at 8 o'clock in the morning, and pass an hour alone with Mr. Wilkinson, of the Theatres Royal, in Golden Square, an hour alone. It was 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3 now jump right foot more out, Mr. Smith, and if you could try, and look a little more cheerful, your partner, sir, would like you all the better. Wilkinson called me Smith. For the fact is, I did not tell him my real name, nor, thank heaven, does he know it to this day. I never breathed a word of my doings to any soul among my friends. Once a pack of them met me in the strange neighborhood, when, I am ashamed to say, I muttered something about a little French milliner, and walked off, looking as knowing as I could. In Paris, 2 Cambridge men and myself, who happened to be staying at a boarding house together, agreed to go to Cowlin, a little creature of 4 feet high with a pigtail. His room was hung round with glasses. He made us take off our coats, and dance each before a mirror. Once he was standing before us playing on his kit the sight of the little master, and the pupil was so supremely ridiculous, that I burst into a yell of laughter, which so offended the old man, that he walked away abruptly, and begged me not to repeat my visits. Nor did one. I was just getting into waltzing then, but determined to drop waltzing, and content myself with quadrilling for the rest of my days. This was all very well in France and England, but in Germany what was I to do? What did Hercules do when Omphale captivated him? What did Ronaldo do when Armida fixed upon him her twinkling eyes? Nay, to cut all historical instances short, by going at once to the earliest, what did Adam do when Eve tempted him? He yielded and became her slave, and so I do heartily trust every honest man will yield until the end of the world he has no heart who will not. When I was in Germany, I say, I began to learn to waltz. The reader from this will no doubt expect that some new love adventures befell me, nor will his gentle heart be disappointed. Two deep and tremendous incidents occurred which shall be notified on the present occasion. The reader, perhaps, remembers the brief appearance of His Highness the Duke of Kalbsbrücken Pumpernickel at B House, in the first part of my memoirs, at that unlucky period of my life, when the Duke was led to remark the odor about my clothes, which lost me the hand of Mary Mallister. I somehow found myself in His Highness's territories, of which anybody may read a description in the Almanach de Gotha. His Highness's father, as is well known, married Amelia Cunegunda Thomasina Charleria Emanuela Luia Georgina, Princess of Saxe-Pumpernickel, and a cousin of His Highness the Duke. Thus the two principalities were united under one happy sovereign in the person of Philibert Sigismund Emanuel Maria, the reigning Duke, who has received from his country on account of the celebrated pump which he erected in the marketplace of Kalbsbrücken, the well-merited appellation of the Magnificent. The allegory which the statues round about the pump represent is of a very mysterious and complicated sort. Minerva is observed leading up Ceres to a river god, who has his arms round the neck of Pomona, while Mars, in a full-bottomed wig, is driven away by Peace, under whose mantle two lovely children, representing the Duke's two provinces, repose. The celebrated Spec is, as need scarcely be said, the author of this piece, and of other magnificent edifices in the residence, such as the guard room, the skittle hall Grasserzoglich Kolbstraten Pumpernickelisch Gittelspielsel, and see and the superb sentry boxes before the Grand Ducal Palace. He is Knight Grand Cross of the ancient Kartoffel Order, as, indeed, is almost everyone else in His Highness's dominions. The town of Kalbsbrücken contains a population of 2,000 inhabitants, and a palace which would accommodate about six times that number. The principality sends 3.5 men to the German Confederation, who are commanded by a General Excellency, 2 major generals, and 64 officers of lower grades, all noble, all knights of the order, and almost all chamberlains to His Highness the Grand Duke. An excellent band of 80 performers is the admiration of the surrounding country, and leads the Grand Ducal troops to battle in time of war. Only 3 of the contingent of soldiers returned from the Battle of Waterloo, where they won much honor. The remainder was cut to pieces on that glorious day. There is a chamber of representatives which, however, nothing can induce to sit, home and foreign ministers, residents from neighboring courts, law presidents, town councils, and see, all the adjuncts of a big or little government. The court has its chamberlains and marshals, the Grand Duchess her noble ladies in waiting, and blushing maids of honor. Thou wert one, Dorothea. Dost remember the poor young Englander? We parted in anger, but I think thou hast not forgotten him. The way in which I have Dorothea von Speck present to my mind is this. Not as I first saw her in the garden, for her hair was in bandeau then, and a large leghorn hat with a deep ribbon covered half her fair face, not in a morning dress, which, by the way, was none of the newest nor the best made, but as I saw her afterwards at a ball at the pleasant, splendid little court, where she moved the most beautiful of the beauties of Kalbsbrücken. The grand saloon of the palace is lighted. The Grand Duke and his officers, the Duchess and her ladies, have passed through. I, in my uniform, of the TH, and a number of young fellows who are evidently admiring my legs and envying my distinct appearance, are waiting round the entrance door, where a huge Heyduke is standing, and announcing the titles of the guests as they arrive. Herr Oberhof und Bau Inspector von Speck, shouts the Heyduke, and the little inspector comes in. His lady is on his arm huge, in towering plumes, and her favorite costume of light blue. fair women always dress in light blue or light green, and Frau von Speck is very fair and stout. But who comes behind her? Lieber Himmel, it is Dorothea. Did Earth, among all the flowers which have sprung from its bosom, produce ever one more beautiful? She was none of your heavenly beauties, I tell you. She had nothing ethereal about her. No, sir, she was of the earth earthy, and must have weighed 10 stone 4 or 5, if she weighed an ounce. She had none of your Chinese feet, nor waspy, unhealthy waists, which those may admire who will. No. Dora's foot was a good stout one. You could see her ankle if her robe was short enough, without the aid of a microscope. And that envious little, sour, skinny Amalia von Mangelwurzel used to hold up her four fingers, and say the two girls were most intimate friends, of course. Dear Dorothea's waist is so much thicker as this. And so I have no doubt it was. But what then? Goethe sings in one of his divine epigrams. Epicures vaunting their taste, entitle me vulgar and savage, give them their Brussels sprouts, but I am contented with cabbage. I hate your little women, that is, when I am in love with a tall one, and who would not have loved Dorothea? Fancy her, then, if you please, about 5 feet 4 inches high. Fancy her in the family color of light blue, a little scarf covering the most brilliant shoulders in the world, and a pair of gloves clinging close round an arm that may, perhaps, be somewhat too large now, but that Juno might have envied then. After the fashion of young ladies on the continent, she wears no jewels or gimcracks. Her only ornament is a wreath of vine leaves in her hair, with little clusters of artificial grapes. Down on her shoulders falls the brown hair, in rich liberal clusters. All that health, and good humor, and beauty can do for her face, kind nature has done for hers. Her eyes are frank, sparkling, and kind. As for her cheeks, what paint box or dictionary contains pigments or words to describe their red? They say she opens her mouth and smiles always, to show the dimples in her cheeks. Sah! She smiles because she is happy, and kind, and good-humored, and not because her teeth are little pearls. All the young fellows crowd up to ask her to dance, and, taking from her waist a little mother-of-pearl remembrancer, she notes them down. Old Schnabel for the Polonaise, Klingenspur, first waltz, Harbert, second waltz, Count Hornpieper, the Danish envoy, third, and so on. I have said why I could not ask her to waltz, and I turned away with a pang, and played Eckert with Colonel Trumpenpack all night. In thus introducing this lovely creature in her ball costume, I have been somewhat premature, and had best go back to the beginning of the history of my acquaintance with her. Dorothea, then, was the daughter of the celebrated Speck before mentioned. It is one of the oldest names in Germany, where her father's and mother's houses, those of Speck and Ayer, are loved wherever they are known. Unlike his warlike progenitor, Lorenzo, Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.